The controversial new film 12 Years a Slave has been touted as the front runner for this year's Best Picture Oscar. It depicts the memoir of a free black man who was kidnapped into slavery. While some are heralding it as an honest portrait, others complain it's an exaggerated work of fiction. What movies have dealt with depictions of slavery best and which ones have failed? How has our narrative of slavery changed throughout cinematic history? We want your thoughts. I'm Russ Simmons, and on today's Central Standard, the film critics will review 12 Years a Slave, as well as other films currently at your local cinemas. That's coming up right after this news. Good morning, Kansas City, and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Russ Simmons, and once again, it's movie day here on Central Standard. I'm joined by some of my fellow film critics, and we'll be talking about movies that have opened up in the Kansas City area over the last month or so. I'm with Fox 4 and KKFI FM, and I'm joined today on the panel by...
I'm Eric Moline, and I'm with SceneStealers.com, Lawrence Journal World, and KCTV5.
And I'm John Tibbetts. I teach film at the University of Kansas.
And one of the more controversial films that has opened up over the last month is a film called 12 Years a Slave that has been touted as a favorite to win the Academy Award for Best Picture, and it's certainly a very strong film. And what we want to do is we want to find out what you think about the depiction of slavery in the cinema is really like. When have they got it right? When have they got it wrong? What do you think? And we want to hear from you and about any of the other movies we'll be talking about. And the number is 816-235-2888. Once again, that's 816-235-2888. Or you can contact us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Or you can touch base on Facebook or tweet us. We'll find you. Just chime in. We want to hear what you have to say. A little bit later on, after the half, we're going to be bringing in a special guest, Professor Kevin Wilmot from the University of Kansas, who, as a filmmaker, has made a film about slavery that dealt with it in a tangential way, the mock documentary called CSA, Confederate States of America. So we'll be getting his feedback on this topic as well. But since 12 Years a Slave is so controversial, I think we should jump right in and start talking about that right away. So, John, what was your take?
An amazing film. Two films this year, Best Pictures. Could not be more different. Gravity and 12 Years a Slave. Or are they? I don't know. That would be fun to investigate. An amazing film. Yes, sometimes difficult to watch. But yes, one of the most superbly constructed and executed films I have ever seen. I submit 60 seconds into this film, you know that you're in the presence of a masterpiece.
Wow.
But yes, difficult to watch. Time span, 1841. A free man ends up being shanghaied to Washington, D.C., and thence to a series of southern plantations. I think there are three different plantation owners that he encounters, as he is now totally ignored as a free man. Now as a black man, he is a slave. And the best he can do to survive is to completely deny that he knows how to read, that he was once a free man, etc. That just gets him into more trouble. Eric, try working at a broadcast medium like Channel 5, being a PhD, and doing your best to hide it. A weird analogy, perhaps, but it's a situation that this man faces. He cannot be the man he is in order to survive. He has to submerge all of that. And with these three different plantation owners, three different sets of experiences that he has to deal with in his survival strategies, Benedict Cumberbatch and Michael Fassbender are two of the overseers. Brad Pitt is along for the ride. Brad Pitt is a kind of a redeeming presence in this picture. And the fact that he helped produce the film, But without getting into too much, I mean, graphic, yes. I will mention two scenes just quickly. One is when he is being forced to whip a young lady who has been named Patsy. She has been kind of a plaything of the plantation owner. And he finds himself forced to whip her, to flay the skin off her back. I won't go any more than that, but that is tough to watch. Fair warning. And another in which our young man is, well, he's being lynched, frankly. And one of the overseers prevents it from being carried out, but then leaves him to be hanging there in the yard, feet barely touching the ground. And in an extended take, you watch him struggling for air, his toes struggling to make contact with the ground as he hangs there. Now, I've mentioned these two scenes as a fair warning for those of you to be prepared, but don't under any circumstances let this deter you from going. Take young people to this film with a due proviso. School kids, high school kids, they must go see this film. This is a history that has too long been denied, covered up by guess who? Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be talking about that. And yes, it's tough to watch, but this is an important film. And I will conclude simply by reminding everyone, if you care about how well a film is constructed, if there are some aesthetic issues that you care about the filmmaking process, this film excels in those respects too. Steve McQueen has crafted, beautifully crafted a film. Highest ratings here. And of course, you're left with the irony. How can a film that is so beautifully done also be so difficult to watch?
True enough. And out of 5 stars, what would you give it?
Out of 5 stars, I give it 6.
Yeah. Well, we're definitely on the same page here. This is a really terrific movie. But I think the word that you said in your review there, important, is the standout word, because it is an important film, not just because of how it's made, how it's well acted, and so on. Chiwetel Ejiofor will undoubtedly get an Oscar nomination as Best Actor. The film will definitely get nominations for Best Picture and Director and probably Screenplay. And even probably some of the supporting actors will receive nominations. It's important because of the content. It's important because what it tells us about ourselves and what it tells us about the time and what it tells us about slavery. But more important, the contemporary world, what it tells us about our feelings now about slavery. Because as we're going to be talking about in a little bit, through the years, our perception of slavery has changed and our depiction of slavery is different in different films that we've seen over the years. But today, when we see this really brutal depiction, mm-hmm. makes you think, what does that tell us about the now? And I think that's the part that's really important.
And it is not a brutality that is ever gratuitous. It is not just sensation mongering. At the word, meaning, it means something in this picture. Regardless of how extreme it may seem at moments, it is actually under a very tight control.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me realize, when we get to talking about Hollywood, generically speaking, the most important film about the black experience in America was made by an independent producer nobody had ever heard of. Dudley Murphy, I think, was his name. That's Emperor Jones with Paul Robeson. Well, who's seen that?
Right.
Would Hollywood have even taken that on its own? No way.
Yes. And, interestingly enough, this is a film that was written by people of African descent. It was directed by a person of African descent. The stars, obviously, as well. This is the first time that I'm aware of that this perspective has been shown on the big screen, particularly in a Hollywood film. And I think that that's another thing that makes it, quote unquote, important.
But it hasn't somehow invested the film with some kind of a smug, self-glorifying, or propagandistic message. It's just there.
Yeah.
The filmmakers have let the material alone to that extent and allowed it to speak for itself.
I agree. And you know what? Another thing, and I'm opening up a can of worms here, so I'm just going to go for it and see what happens. The other day, I saw an article in Investor's Business Daily. It was an editorial.
Well, I read that journal all the time.
Yes. And it said that the book itself was really written by a white abolitionist try to justify the Civil War. And so its depiction of slavery has been overdone and exaggerated, and it really wasn't as brutal as people are saying it is. Well, you know, to my way of thinking, that sounds a little bit like Holocaust deniers.
Yeah.
You know?
And when, it was written by Mel Gibson, that article. Yeah.
And when Kevin Wilmot arrives, let's suggest to him that the Civil War was really all about states' rights.
Oh, yeah.
And then stand back.
Right.
Yeah.
It would be really interesting hearing Kevin's perspective again, because he did direct that film CSA, which, and there haven't been a whole lot of films that have depicted it. It's only, even when it is a topic in a Hollywood film, it's kind of a ancillary issue.
Yeah. Or like John Sayles' Brother from Another Planet. You know, mm-hmm. You kind of go off into margins to somehow get a message across.
Have you seen 12 Years a Slave? Did you think of its depiction? You can give us a call and let us know at 816-235-2888 or tweet us at KCURCST. We'll be taking your calls and we'll be reading your messages as well as emails and Facebook postings. Just let us know what you think about this topic, and we're going to be returning to that topic after the break. We're both giving it a 5, so that's a big 5, mm-hmm. Our highest rating for 12 Years a Slave, rated R, and it definitely earns that R rating. So let's jump into another movie that opens today, and I believe Eric is the only one that was able to catch it. It's a film called How I Live Now.
Yeah, How I Live Now is directed by Kevin MacDonald, who brought us The Last King of Scotland, which won Forrest Whitaker an Oscar some years back. And since then, he's kind of all over the place. He does documentaries like One Day in September and Marley. He also did State of Play, the thriller based on the British series with Russell Crowe. He's a very – I don't know how to say it. He's an inconsistent director, and I think that this adaptation of a young adult novel starring Saoirse Ronan, who people will probably know from The Lovely Bones and Hannah, is pretty – mixed, honestly. I like the idea of a young adult novel that takes the maturation of a teenager very seriously, instead of being soapy and pulpy like the Twilight movies and things like that. There is a supernatural element to this in that there's some sort of weird psychic connection that she has with the boy that she falls in love with. But essentially what this is a bratty American teenager who goes to the English countryside to stay with her cousins. And while she's there, we see these hints. We see the military everywhere, planes flying overhead. There's a nuclear explosion in London, and they are in the middle of World War III. And basically, it turns into an apocalyptic survival story. The kids all get separated. The guys go one way, and the girls go another. And it becomes this survival story. It's moderately interesting, but it kind of loses me there because we've seen that trope before and we've seen this idea so many times. And what is she fighting for? What is she hoping to get at the end of the rainbow here is to meet up with her boyfriend. And so on one hand, I appreciate the realistic treatment that MacDonald gives the story. And I thought it was mildly interesting, but it didn't hold my attention. And ultimately, I don't think it really has anything new to say. But Kevin MacDonald, interesting guy, and Saoirse Ronan's a great actress, but very mixed on this one. Out of 5, mm-hmm. I guess, I'll give it 2.5.
All right.
And that's How I Live Now.
Yeah. How I Live Now, rated R. And speaking of survival stories, let's pick up on one that opens today. Robert Redford gives a solo performance that is undoubtedly going to get him an Oscar nomination for a film that plays a little bit like a Earthbound version of Gravity. It's called All Is Lost. Redford plays a man who's out sailing in the open ocean. His boat becomes disabled and starts to sink. His radio doesn't work, so what do you do? The odds are pretty much insurmountable. What does he do and what would you do? It really does a good job of putting you in his shoes. This is a really harrowing film that I think is deceptively simple in its story. It's just a guy out in a boat. What's he going to do? However, it really does bring up some very fundamental questions about the value of the single human life, the survival instinct, what do we feel is truly important, and how do we feel about a lot of our own personal interactions with others and ourselves? How does that all play in to our viewing of this film? So it's all about your own perceptions you're bringing to the film.
Yeah, Russ, how does all that play into your own viewing of this film?
Well, I found it extremely riveting.
Yeah, well, yeah. I may be the only voice you hear these days that says, it was lost on me. I sat there watching Robert Redford gainfully, manfully trying to survive and basically saying, so what? It's a fragment. You know very little about the setup of the picture other than a voiceover. I won't say how it ends, but there's a big so what on that one. And in the middle of it, I saw kind of an old man in the sea type story.
Right.
And I liked it only a little better than the Spencer Tracy version. I just don't get it. You see an older guy climbing up a mast and trying to stay alive underwater. And
no,
honestly, it just didn't grab me at all.
J.C. Shander was the director of this, and he was nominated for an Oscar some years back for Margin Call, which was a very talky screenplay. And from what I hear, this doesn't have any dialogue.
No, not at all, except for that voiceover, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, in exasperation, he says a couple of curse words, but that's really pretty much about it. You know, his performance is strictly one that you view from his countenance. You don't get it from anything that he says, because he doesn't really say anything.
I've heard that, too. It's all in his face.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thought it was beautifully done.
Yeah.
So out of five, how many?
Two.
Two? Okay, I'm giving it four, so we'll average that out to a 3 for All Is Lost, rated PG-13. If you've seen Gravity, many of you have, I think the best depiction of this movie is that it's gravity on Earth. So
it's pretty earthbound for a seafaring yard.
Yes, but without the same level of special effects, I guess.
But
right?
It is one of those films where that makes it all worthwhile to be a so-called film critic, in that you measure your own reactions against the consensus. And in this case, it's been great fun for me to wonder, what was I thinking? Mm-hmm. What was I watching? Where did I go wrong?
There you are.
Or where did everybody else go wrong?
Now, let's chat about another film that opened back on October 18th that all three of us have seen. It's a remake of a 70s horror classic, and it's called Carrie.
Yeah, Carrie is not as cinematically exciting as the Brian De Palma version, which if you do decide to go see this, don't make the mistake that I did and watch the original the very same day before you go see it. Because Kimberly Pierce, as a filmmaker, I think she's great. I love Boys Don't Cry. I thought Stop Loss was very powerful. And I think she tries to play tribute to it here, but I don't think Chloe Grace Moretz is any substitute for Sissy Spacek. I liked Julianne Moore adding a little more depth to the Piper Laurie role, which I thought was interesting. Both Spacek and Laurie were nominated for an Oscar, and Laurie's performance is so campy and over the top. I really appreciated that Julianne Moore brought something more realistic to the role. But then when it came time to the setup was all there, but then when it came time for Carrie to manifest her powers fully, we had already seen too much of them, and she wielded them with such with such precision. It was like watching Harry Potter and people throwing the wands around. And so for me, Carrie, it doesn't have any of the cinematic panache of the original or any of the weird, sexual tension. So for me, it was, I guess, a 2 out of 5.
Yeah.
I like what you say about we see too much of her powers beforehand. For example, there she is in the school lunchroom reading a book on telekinesis. I mean, come on. There, she's reading up on her own powers. I thought the whole idea was that she was not in control of her own powers, that she did not understand. It's called adolescence, which is what the film is really about.
True.
It's called bullying,
right?
Which is what the story is really all about. Julianne Moore, I've got to disagree with Eric. I thought Julianne Moore, compared to Piper Laurie, I'll take Piper Laurie.
Well, I'm not saying I didn't like Piper Laurie. I'm just saying Piper Laurie was going for a way campier thing.
Well, maybe Julianne Moore is such a fine actress.
Yes.
Okay, across the board. Maybe she was so good in the role that I just totally hated her in this. I hated her character, could not relate in any way to it. Piper Laurie was just out of it from the get-go.
Yeah.
And for some reason, the idea that Carrie would be hurling knives at her in the De Palma version was such a great effect. Totally nothing here. I think 2 is a fairly generous rating, but I'll go along with it.
Yeah, I might give it just a little bit more because I think perhaps there were some aspects of modernizing it that I thought did actually work. But it's certainly not in the same league as the Brian De Palma version of Carrie. It's kind of a tepid remake. So I'll say 2.5, but let's all just call it 2 for what it is. That's Carrie rated R. I want to mention that we got an email from Nancy in response to our question about the movie 12 Years a Slave. And she said, 12 Years is the best movie of the year. It is absolutely a work of art, and I will be seeing it again. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably true of a lot of people. But on the other hand, I've heard from a number of people that said, if it's that brutal, I don't think I can bear to watch it. And true enough,
that's
understandable.
That's why I want to emphasize the sheer craft of this picture. If you go see it again, you'll be in a position more to appreciate it on that level.
Once again, the number is 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCURCST. Let's talk very quickly about another film we've all three seen. It's based on Orson Scott Card's famous youth science fiction novel series, and the movie is called Ender's Game.
Let's see. Young men playing video games and resorting to violence. I kind of think that sums up.
That's still very timely.
What does that
right?
tell us about ourselves?
But it was timely in a way that was maybe different when I was reading it, much closer to the Vietnam era thing, when young people were being drafted and then turned into killing machines. Well, these young people are placed into this environment where they learn how to be killing machines at a distance. We're talking killing distance here that Hemingway talks about, how much easier it is to wreak havoc from a great distance. And in this case, Ender and the gang are able to do that. They think it's, well, no, I won't reveal that plot point. Harrison Ford looks a little younger than I've seen him look. Has there been some work done lately? He's an over-the-top military fascistic type who has recruited Ender into this program to defeat an alien race that may just be planning another invasion. So what do we do? Let's do a preemptive strike.
I love that you use the word fascistic already to describe Harrison Ford, because this movie reminded me a lot of Starship Troopers, which does take that satire over the top and give the military commanders those fascist designs and outfits and things like that. Seeing Doogie Howser turned into a Nazi scientist is really hilarious.
And another insect race.
Yeah, and another insect race. Yeah. There's a lot of parallels.
What is this about bugs?
But this is not a satire. Ender's Game is a very straightforward drama. What I liked about it, and even better than the book, which I read many years ago, was that it keeps Ender grounded in this morality of whether or not he's doing the right thing the whole time. It starts off with a quote from him, and you're thinking about it while he's thinking about it. And I thought Asa Butterfield, the kid from Hugo, who was so good there, is really excellent in this. And I think he kind of elevated the movie to a certain level. And by streamlining the novel, I think they did a good job of focusing on that. So it was a surprise for me.
I could have wished for more with the sister. Ender's sister is a very important figure in the story. Mm-hmm. But like you say, you've got to streamline things. It was a movie better than I thought it would be, which is saying something.
Well, you know, the themes of militarism versus pacifism come through strongly on the written page. I'm not sure they came through strongly enough in the film. But on its own, you know, it's mildly entertaining. So how many stars are we going to give it?
3.
Yeah, 3 for me too.
And 3 for me as well. So that's Ender's Game, rated PG-13. It is beautifully produced. So
good-looking.
It is a good-looking movie. We want to bring Hillary into the conversation, who wants to talk about 12 Years a Slave. Hi, Hillary.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thank you. Thanks for calling.
No, of course. Well, I saw 12 Years a Slave, and it is by far the best movie I've seen all year. I actually plan on taking my 14-year-old brother to go see it this weekend, just because I think he's at that age where he can really understand what's going on, and I think it's really important for youth to go see this movie just to see how important part of history it is.
And what about any other aspects of this that you think it's, even though it's rated R, that it's okay for 14-year-olds or under to see?
I really think as long as you prep your children or whoever you're taking for what, like, the context of it, I really do think it's appropriate. I mean, there's no cussing. It's not excessive because it's historically accurate. And I think if you prepare a child to go see it, that it really could be meaningful. I'm not saying go take a 10-year-old.
Right.
But I think that, you know, preteens and teenagers can definitely see this movie.
Hey, thank you, Hillary. Really appreciate your call.
Of course. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk quickly about a couple other movies before we have to take a break. And again, we will be joined by Dr. Kevin Wilmot from the University of Kansas, who will be bringing his expertise into this conversation. I do also want to mention that Mark from KCMO tells us there's a TV version of 12 Years a Slave that was made about 10 years ago. I like the TV version better than the theatrical version. The Steve McQueen version was just too brutal for me. Eric, I see you're nodding. Did you see the TV version?
No, I haven't seen it, but I believe it was a miniseries on PBS. Something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I missed that as well. So, but that's interesting.
The whole thing's online. Somebody put the whole thing up on YouTube.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing.
That's how I found out about it.
And, you know, how many years are we away from Roots? What a national phenomenon that was. But our memories are so darned flawed. And the world is an ephemeral world. And we need these reminders every once
True.
In a while to kickstart the fact this is not an exaggeration, what you're watching on this screen. This really happened.
1977 was when Roots came out, the TV version, yeah. Let's talk quickly, John, if you would, about Last Vegas. Talk about a movie from another cinematic universe.
Well, every once in a while, we are so conflicted in watching a film. Because really, for the first half, I mean, come on. Several codgers who make old age jokes. I cannot stand old age jokes. I'm sorry, as I'm getting there myself. I'm getting more sensitive to this. Adrift in Las Vegas, seemingly pretty healthy, seemingly fixed up with money, seemingly well stocked up in their attractions with and to ladies of the evening. Everything seems to be going real well. Do we have to wind this up in a minute?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'll just quickly say, at the same time in the second half, it does get into more human issues with these four guys and their foibles and frailties. So I liked the second half pretty much. Did not like the first half. So between a 2 and a 4, I'll go a 3.
Yeah, I'm kind of right there with you. You know, this is a movie that should have been just awful. Because when you hear that dialogue, you're saying, holy cow, if this had been in the coming out of the mouths of lesser actors, this would have been absolutely unbearable. But thankfully, you've got Morgan Freeman, you've got Michael Douglas, you've got Kevin Kline, and also Robert De Niro. You really can't go wrong with these guys. And they really bring humanity to it. And I also like
Mary Steenburgen.
There you go. Thank you. Mary Steenburgen, who I believe does her own singing, and she does a nice job as a lounge singer who becomes a love interest for kind of another element of conflict.
We won't say which for which guy, though.
But I said this movie, I enjoyed it in spite of itself and much more than I should have. So I'm giving it a 3 as well. So once again, that's Last Vegas rated PG-13. Once again, we want to hear your feedback on the topic of slavery as depicted in the cinema. And we're going to be talking about that after the half with our colleague, Dr. Kevin Wilmot of the University of Kansas. So you can call us at 816-235-2888 and join in on the conversation. We'll also have a few announcements, and we'll be back right after this. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Russ Simmons, joined by my colleagues Eric Moline and John Tibbetts. We're talking about movies that have opened up over the last month or so, as well as the topic of slavery as depicted in the cinema. We want to hear what you think. Did you see 12 Years a Slave? What other films have you seen that deal with this topic? Did they get it right? Did they get it wrong? We want to know what you think, so give us a call, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCURCST. You can also send us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. I just have a few quick announcements before we jump back in with both feet here. I wanted to let everybody know that Cinema KC is presenting Gangland Wire from producer Gary Jenkins with proceeds benefiting Cinema KC. And this is a locally produced documentary about the Kansas City Mafia. It's playing at the Screenland Crown Center through the 21st of November, a couple of shows a day. So you want to find out more information about that, go to kcur.org. We'll have that information for you there. Also, Overland Park-based Inland Sea Productions is premiering their latest documentary, a full-length IMAX film called We the People, and that's playing at Union Station, Kansas City. And they'll be having 5 shows a day through the 20th. And it's directed by Amy Larrabee from Inland Sea Production, so it's a locally based production dealing with the origins of our country, and Morgan Freeman and Kenny Rogers serve as the narrators. So again, more information is available at kcur.org. And our friend Jerry Harrington at the Tivoli is having a Kickstarter campaign because it's go digital or go dark time for them. The motion pictures are switching over, as many of you know, to a digital format only, so film is on the way out. And Jerry needs to spend a lot of money to upgrade his equipment. And the independent cinemas don't have the same breaks that the chains get. So he has to come up with a lot of dough. And so he's asking for your help with a Kickstarter campaign to raise money for those digital projectors. And you can help out the Tivoli and keep that Kansas City's oldest independent cinema open by helping out there. And again, more information at kcur.org. And speaking of the Tivoli, their National Theater Live series continues with Kenneth Branagh in Macbeth, Richard Griffiths in The Habit of Art, and Benedict Cumberbatch and Johnny Lee Miller in Frankenstein. These are all playing at the Tivoli. We can find out all of that and much, much more at kcur.org. At this time, I'd like to welcome into the conversation an extremely talented gentleman, and I really appreciate your time for coming in to see us, Dr. Kevin Wilmot of the University of Kansas Film School. And he did, a few years back, a film called CSA, The Confederate States of America, which was a mock documentary that dealt with the idea that what would America be like today had the South won the war. And so we thought it would be interesting to get Kevin's perspective on this subject of slavery. And first of all, Kevin, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Russ.
And tell us, have you seen the movie yet?
You know, unfortunately, I have not seen the movie yet. As I always like to joke, all the good movies take a while to come to Lawrence.
Isn't
that amazing?
So I haven't seen it yet, but I've read quite a bit about it and pretty familiar with it.
Now, dealing with this topic, obviously, you're a professor of cinema. What movies have dealt with this that you felt was in a responsible and historically accurate way, and when have they gotten it wrong?
Well, you know, I have to say that I'm pretty tough critic on the subject matter. You know, I think this is the first film to ever kind of get it right, to be honest with you. I mean, Glory is a fine film in a lot of ways, but you know, typically the problem with the subject matter is that you know, there's always a surrogate that kind of tells the story of the film. You know, I kind of call it you know, it's the Tom Cruise tells us about the samurai, or you know, you know, Kevin Costner tells us about the Sioux Indians.
Right. Which actually directed by the same guy. Ed Zwick did Glory and The Last Samurai.
Exactly. Yeah. And 12 Years a Slave is I think the first film to really kind of have it from an African American point of view, and that I think is always critical to the subject matter. You know, it's like you're seeing it through the eyes of a slave, not someone from the outside telling you what's going on with the slave. You're actually seeing it from a guy who is a free man, which allows you to understand what slavery then is, because, you know, it's the same thing I tried to do with CSA in many ways, is that, you know, you're looking at it from a modern perspective inside of slavery. So the fact that he's a free man and then you go inside the issue of slavery makes it dramatically different in terms of how you see these issues.
Now, before I forget, we want people to see CSA. So how do they see it?
It's on Netflix. You can see it on Netflix, and you know, it's on iTunes. It's pretty readily available.
It's definitely worth seeing. It's wicked, wickedly funny.
Now, tell me, in your opinion, is historical accuracy more important than dramatic or cinematic success?
Well, you know, it's tough to do both. You know, it's a balancing act, and I think both are obviously you've got to entertain or you're kind of sunk. But historical accuracy is important, and you know, but I think it's more about emotional accuracy, and that's the thing that appears. Again, I haven't seen the film yet, but it appears that 12 Years a Slave gets right is the emotional dynamic of all this, that, you know, the fact that it's disturbing is great. Mm-hmm. It should be disturbing, and it should be very disturbing. And that's been the problem with most movies about slavery. It's not disturbing.
Right. Hey, well, you know, your depiction in CSA is obviously satiric, and I think most people get the satire. But have you had any pushback from people who said that this is not the right approach? Or
let me tell you, I could go on for months. But, you know, the best story about that is Larry Peterson, who plays Fauntleroy in the film and who's kind of the bad guy villain in the film. And one day he was being honored in Kansas City for his work as a in film, really, and as an actor. And they showed a clip of CSA, and the audience was so shocked, he was fired.
Wow.
And he was a vice president at Time Warner here in town. And he was fired because, and I always tell people, you know, it's like Hannibal Lecter isn't actually eating those people in the movie. He's an actor. And,
right.
And but it tells you how powerful the image and the subject matter of slavery and racism is. It's so powerful that people can't even deal with it as you as an actor portraying it on screen.
It's crazy.
I think the most devastating aspect of CSA, and maybe it's a bit lost on some, is that in some ways you show that the South really did win the Civil War. It's most, that may be the most difficult thing to somehow wrap your mind around, but look around you.
You know, I would argue that's definitely the case. I mean, I think you see it all the time in national elections. The country's still very much divided, you know, red state, blue state. You know, it's an ongoing conflict.
What, did you see the Saturday Night Live sketch from last week where there was talking about what it would take for a black person not to vote for Obama? That was about the funniest thing I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And it's just like, it speaks to that division. What I wanted to talk about, what I thought was really interesting, was last year's Django Unchained. You've got Tarantino, who's a filmmaker who deals in these exploitation kind of motifs. And in the movie, he has two very different kinds of violence. In the same film, he's got Mandingo fighting, which is slave pitted against slave, brutal, awful violence meant to churn your stomach and make you feel horrible. And then at the end of the movie, cartoony, over-the-top revenge violence with Jamie Foxx just blowing white people away. And they're in the same film.
Right.
I mean, that was bizarre. That was really tough.
Well, I always tell people I saw Django back in 1974 when it was called Boss In, starring Fred Williamson.
Right.
And and you know, the thing about exploitation violence, like you're talking about, it really allows you to divorce yourself from the reality of things. And I think that's the thing that 12 Years a Slave is getting right, probably, is that, you know, it gets you up close and personal, and then you get to see the emotional baggage and the emotional reality that goes along with the violence.
Now, we don't want to put you in a position of setting you up as an official spokesperson or anything like that.
But that's okay, Russ.
But I was curious, as an African-American filmmaker,
sure.
What is important to you? What do you wish people would consider when they write films, and what do you wish people would think about when they go to see a film?
Well, I think point of view is a big thing for me, and because I've seen it, I've seen that problem in Hollywood so much. I think The Help is another example of a point of view problem. You know, it's always this other person that's going to tell the story, and Hollywood just doesn't believe that white people can get that close to black pain without a white person saying, "Let me tell you about it." And that's the problem in Hollywood. And I just don't believe that's true. I think white people are better than that. And I think this movie is hopefully going to prove that.
Yeah. Now, let's take a step back and talk about some of the other movies that have dealt with slavery. Birth of a Nation, obviously, is a classic motion picture, but its depiction is not particularly flattering, to say the least. The KKK is heroic. The African Americans are lazy, you know, and scufflaws. And once they receive their freedom, they're bad people. They've turned from good, honest slaves to horrible free men.
Well, the film had an impact on the resurgence of the Ku Klux Klan
right.
in the 20s.
So I guess my question to you is, given the content of Birth of a Nation and the fact that it is a great piece of cinema,
right.
In what context today do we view this movie?
Well,
or should we?
I showed the film in class and in my African American Images class, and all of the stereotypes, the five stereotypes, the mammy, the buck, the Tom, the mulatto, and the coon, all were created from that film, and propagated from that film. And the most, I think, it's important to watch that film from the point of view of race. And I think you know, if you show your kids that film and then kind of explain to them kind of how this all started, in a sense, I think it's a great film to kind of watch. The key scene in that film is a scene near the end of the movie where they have this. It's a silent film. They have title cards, enter title cards, and there's a scene where there's some Northern soldiers, former Northern soldiers, who then side with the Southern troops, with the Klan, against these black soldiers who are now kind of, you know, are raping and terrorizing the white community. And the intertitle says talks about Aryan Brotherhood in it. And I think it's a kind of about how North and South came together to kind of win the war for the South, in a sense, and right. And kind of what the subject of CSA is. And also you get to see how they become friends in kind of racism.
You're listening to Central Standard here on KCUR, and you can join the conversation by calling us at 816-235-2888. You can also send us a tweet at KCURCST or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. John?
Yeah, an interesting discussion, too, comes from the context of Griffith's making of this. He pointed out, and others have, yes, standard textbooks in the South, their version of the Civil War is simply what they were portraying. Let us not leave textbooks off the hook here. How textbooks depict American history, to me, is one of the great unsung tragedies of the American experience. Look at Texas recently with the whole textbook controversy. You can use that as an argument saying, well, that's what the textbook told us
right.
about the experience. Well, it's what it shouldn't have told us, and we need to know that. And these textbooks shouldn't be continued to be used as excuses
right.
for the kinds of images that we see on film.
And I wanted to quickly bring in the topic of Mandingo, which is a perfect example of exploitation and racist filmmaking, in my opinion. And but that's a film that people looked at, and well, that's the era for you,
Richard Fleischer.
Right. What is your take on Mandingo?
Well, you know, we were talking about the Mandingo fight in Django, and I mean, I've not done any research on this, but I've read where people have said that did not actually exist in slavery. That those Mandingo fights is a creation of Hollywood, really. You know, who knows for sure, but certainly the inclusion of that in Django, not based maybe in actual research, it lets you know kind of how we like to see slavery. We like to see it, you know, as a sexual kind of giddy thing. We like to see it as a brutal thing, but not in a real thing. And you know, so much of the brutality of slavery is psychological. And I think that's a big part of what 12 Years a Slave seems to be about.
Yeah, yeah. And look at the damage done to our protagonist when he, in effect, is forced to whip the young mm-hmm. black girl.
Right, right.
Wow. I mean, just think about what all is going on in a sequence like that.
Once again, our guest is Professor Kevin Wilmot of the University of Kansas, a filmmaker. And stick around for the next hour with Steve Kraske, because Kevin is going to be talking about another of his films that's going to be coming out soon, the name of which is?
Jayhawkers.
Jayhawkers, about the famous basketball player from KU, Wilt Chamberlain. All right, great. We want to bring Michael into the conversation, who wants to talk about Birth of a Nation. Hi, Michael.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure.
I think part of the issue with the importance of Birth of a Nation is I'm almost 100% sure that Woodrow Wilson ended up having a screening of that film in the White House. And so for the history of the White House, that is the first film being screened at that place.
I understand that that's correct. And of course, he was famously quoted as saying that it was like writing history with lightning.
That could be apocryphal.
But that might, you're exactly right. That's just what I was going to say, that that might have been the filmmaker quoting him.
Yeah. And actually, there's a little, you know, footnote in the film where it says that in the film, that Woodrow Wilson said that about the actual film, which is, the movie even comes with footnotes, which is really tries to make, and of course, Woodrow Wilson was a Southerner as well, and so he had his own point of view with that.
Hey, thanks for your call, Michael.
All right, thanks for having me.
You bet. Jim from Westport, welcome to the conversation.
Hey, this is Jim. Yeah, I was so glad to hear Mr. Wilmot say about the other man telling another man's story, usually when it involves race, with Costner telling the story of the American Indian and Cruise with Samurai. It's just, if you have a Hollywood film involving race, it always seems to be some white guy coming to save the day. And I wish I could think of some examples. Maybe Mississippi Burning, Gene Hackman. I don't know. It just seems to have gone on like that
forever.
Well,
Spielberg's film, too, about the Middle Passage.
And, yeah, Amistad, where Anthony Hopkins raises a heroic flag, as well as Lincoln, for that matter.
Right. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't want to.
Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, I agree with Mr. Wilmot. So I just wanted to. It just kind of made my day in a weird sense to hear that said, because I'm all too aware of it. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim. Thanks for your call. I do want to touch base quickly on some of the other films that have opened over the last month. And Kevin, please chime in if you've seen any of these. We'd like to know your opinion as well. We wanted to make sure that we talked about The Counselor, John.
Yeah. Well, Cormac McCarthy wrote the script, and it sure does show it.
Yes.
As nihilistic and bleak a picture of humankind in general, as you'll see, perhaps this side of 12 Years a Slave, although this is a bunch of white guys here, another drug project gone awry. Everybody that's involved in this thing is going to meet his comeuppance in some fashion or another. But there is a working metaphor in this picture that's very effective. It seems that there's a new device been developed, possibly by Cormac McCarthy, to kill people.
Right.
This is like a noose that can be slipped around the neck of your victim, which triggers a mechanical device, which will then steadily tighten the noose, until either decapitation or a lot of bloodletting results. You cannot get it off. You cannot stop the operation, etc. Well, that's what this film is all about. It sets up a mechanism by which all of these people, in a fatalistic sense, I guess, are all going to come to grief. And it's relentless, and it's inevitable, and there's almost a mechanical kind of working behind the scene called Cormac McCarthy.
That's it.
That's going to make it happen. And so, again, a film that perhaps is tough to watch, but my goodness, what an effective statement it makes about how we are all just a bunch of awful people. but it does have a scene with Uma Thurman. No, Charlize Theron. Excuse me. Uma.
I'm not sure which
actress. Who are we talking about?
Cameron Diaz.
For heaven's sake, my apologies to the others. Cameron Diaz does steal the film with the scene involving her and the front windshield of an automobile. And it's a classic already, probably being set up by Saturday Night Live already, if not soon.
Well, we should say
Cameron Diaz, I'm sorry.
This is directed by Ridley Scott, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of traces of him in there.
No.
When you watch No Country for Old Men, mm-hmm. it very much feels like a movie that is equal parts suspense, thriller, and philosophical discussion. This seems like philosophical discussion 90% of the time,
right.
Because all of the words coming out of the characters' mouths, whether that be Javier Bardem, Michael Fassbender, Penelope Cruz, it's all people speechifying and talking about life and death and consequences. And there's too much foreshadowing in this movie. And I understand the film noir thing where everything's eventually going to go bad at the end. But when they set you up and then they just go through the motions and you don't – there's just no reason. I enjoyed the ideas put forth in it, but I didn't think that the movie itself – worked.
I totally agree. I think that the dialogue was so egregiously over the top. It's the kind of thing that works okay on the printed page, but it just seems awkward when it's up on the big screen.
But the choice of that metaphor
it's work. It's a smart movie, but it's a miscalculation. How many stars out of five?
Two and a half.
I'll go three.
And I will go two, so we'll average that out to two for The Counselor, rated R. I wanted to mention Diana because this is a movie that a lot of people have asked me about. It's a biopic of the Princess of Wales. It deals with the last 2 years of her life and her involvement and affair with a Pakistani Brit, Dr. Hasnat Khan. And boy, I tell you what, as vibrant and lifelike and warm as Princess Diana was, this movie is dull and lifeless and boring. It's like it's a royal bore, unfortunately. So I'm only going to be able to give it a 2.
And that's Naomi Watts, too.
She's wonderful, but she's the only thing that works in this film. Let's quickly talk about Thor, The Dark World, Eric.
So this is part 8.
I put an echo chamber in your voice.
Yeah.
Thor.
Thor. Speaking of speechifying, there's a lot of that from Anthony Hopkins as Odin in this movie. but you know what? This is part 8 in this long Marvel franchise. It is the middle child in a certain respect because it has responsibilities to the past and to the future movies. It acquits itself nicely. It has a nice sense of humor. It has a great slam bang creative action ending. But the first 20 minutes of exposition, oh boy. So, I don't know. I mean, you know what to expect if you're going to see Thor,
You
Dark
got it
World.
Right.
Yeah, Doesn't it seem like he's carrying around a meat tenderizer?
He's tenderizing a lot of meat in this movie, that is for sure. How many stars?
What, out of 5?
Yeah.
3.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. 3. It's good eye candy, but that's really about it. No more, no less than you would expect. The Prime Ministers, The Pioneers is a documentary that's playing right now. It's actually... part of the Simon Wiesenthal Center's film production arm, and it deals with former speechwriter and aide to the first 5 prime ministers of Israel, and his name is Yehuda Avner, and he kind of is an avuncular fellow who serves as the talking head that tells us about Levi Eshkol, Golda Meir, Yitzhak Rabin, Menachem Begin, and Shimon Peres, and gives us kind of a background into their, the founding of the nation of Israel and all of the kinds of insider information that he brings to it. From that respect, it's interesting, but also, boy, this is as dull and dry as you can imagine as a piece of filmmaking.
Yeah, it's a very History Channel type documentary, but he does lend it a little bit of color because he's just, so inviting and he tells a good story. But overall, it's pretty by the books.
And your rating?
2.5 out of 5.
And I'm going to give it a 3, so we'll average that out to a 2.5. We're good with that. That's Prime Ministers, The Pioneers. I want to thank my fellow film critics, Eric Moline, John Tibbetts, and our special guest, Dr. Kevin Wilmot. And please stick around for Up to Date as we continue the conversation with Professor Kevin Wilmot to discuss his most recent films. Our show today was produced by Matthew Long Middleton with Ross Steinmetz, and our announcer is Kim Noble. I'm Russ Simmons. This is Central Standard. Thanks for joining us, and enjoy your weekend.